Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. As a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, it's the Actorly edition of Culturetopia, starting with the young star of True Grit. Hailee Steinfeld talks about playing a determined teenager seeking revenge on her father's killer. Then a profile of Anthony Mackie, best known for his role in last year's The Hurt Locker. He plays a former Black Panther in a well-received new indie called Night Catches Us. And Ben Affleck on his latest film, The Company Men. But first...
In 1726, Jonathan Swift published his book called Travels into Several Remote Nations of the World in Four Parts by Lemuel Gulliver. The novel, of course, is better known as Gulliver's Travels, and it tells the story of the traveler Lemuel Gulliver and his encounters with exotic civilizations, most notably the Lilliputians, who stand 6 inches tall. And had Jonathan Swift been alive to write the screenplay, there's a good chance he'd have chosen the actor Jack Black to play the title role in the retelling of the story that opens in theaters today.
I noticed you had a little eye contact with a princess. How's it going?
Good, yeah. I think if things go well within 2 to 4 years, she may deign to speak to me.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Hold your horses. Oh,
thank God. Thank
you. You can't woo a lady by hoping she'll deign to speak to you. To land a princess, you got to employ some grade A courtage.
Jack Black has played a prickly record store clerk in High Fidelity. He's been an animated panda and a Mexican wrestler, and now a giant among tiny people. Jack Black is in our studios at NPR West. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on this Christmas day.
So you are in this new sweeping historical epic. This is a biopic about a fellow named Lemuel Gulliver. First of all, how did you get inside his head to be able to play him?
Well, in our version of Gulliver's Travels, Lemuel's working in a New York newspaper in the mailroom. He's got dreams of becoming a big travel writer, big shot. Mm. But he's too shy and insecure to make a move and try for the promotion. So it was easy for me to get into that headspace. All I had to do was think back to before I had a, you know, bustling music and acting career.
When you worked you were in mailrooms?
Okay, no, I was not in a mailroom. But I definitely shared the insecurities that go with being an anonymous face in the crowd, one of the little peeps, one of the little small potatoes in a big man's world.
So you get this, you get an assignment from the editor at the travel magazine. You're sent to the Bermuda Triangle, and then what happens?
Yeah, well, so he goes to the Bermuda Triangle to write a piece on it. Unfortunately, he gets sucked into an interdimensional wormhole. Hmm. Everyone knows that's what's at the center of the Bermuda Triangle. And he wakes up on this island called Lilliput, covered in tiny people, and finally gets to be this god-like being, this well-respected big man that he always wanted to be back in New York City.
So let's hear a clip. This is the first time you get to introduce yourself to the Lilliputians.
I'm from the island of Manhattan, between the islands of Staten and Long.
Were you the president?
Oh, well, of course he was, Mother.
Nah, it's a common mistake to not think I was president.
Were you a victorious president?
Yeah, I was pretty victorious. I was actually known as President the Awesome.
So, in this scene, you are towering over these Lilliputians. First of all, what was it like working with such tiny actors?
It was difficult. Mm. There were lots of safety issues, obviously. Whenever I moved my feet, there had to be a warning bell that went off.
Did you accidentally crush any of them?
I did. Unfortunately, that was just part of the experience, and my condolences to all the families that were affected by my girth.
But they were pretty easy to work with in general?
I can't go on with this charade. It was all done with special effects, my man.
But, I mean, that's the thing. It was, and I watched actually some of the B-roll of those special effects. And in a lot of cases, I mean, you're not even on a set with the other actors because obviously there are so many special effects. I mean, is it weird to be like flailing around or talking to someone else in front of a blue screen when there's no one there? I mean, especially when you kind of have to imagine what that scene's going to look like in the end?
It is one of those times when you look at yourself and you go, I have a very strange job. I've had a lot of practice with imagining entire worlds, you know. King Kong, there was never a King Kong there to see. And, of course, you know, all my work with the animation, with the Kung Fu Panda.
Right.
That's all, you know, all imagination.
So a lot of the movie was filmed at Blenheim Palace in England, in Britain. Were you ever there? Did you ever have to go there?
Oh, yeah. We always had to hear each other, our performances live,
right,
so that we maintained that fresh, you know, real relationship between each other, even though we couldn't look at each other in the eyes.
Well, here's one of those clips. This is a scene where you're giving advice to the princess. She's played by Emily Blunt. And at this point, the Lilliputians still think that you are the president.
Gulliver, I will miss you so much.
I'm going to miss you too. Maybe I should stay.
Don't you miss your subjects and the White House and the Millennium Falcon?
Yeah, but Vice President Yoda can run things without me for a while.
Yeah. So much of your acting, I mean, in this film and School of Rock and Kung Fu Panda, so much of it seems improvised. Like, there's no way somebody could have written some of those lines for you.
Well, yeah, a lot of improv happens on the set of my movies. I always like to do it as written to begin with. And then if some ideas come to me, I like to do a take just off the top of my head. I always say, hey, one for fun.
This movie, Gulliver's Travels, it opens today. It's on Christmas Day. I know that you are of the Jewish faith.
Yes.
So I gather that in the best Jewish tradition, the black family will be headed to the movies, maybe have some Chinese?
Actually, we do have some Christian family members. We're going to be going over to my wife's cousin's house for a Christmas celebration. We don't discriminate. We celebrate all holidays. Of all faiths.
Got it. In the tradition of great Jewish artists like Neil Diamond and Irving Berlin, you've put out a Christmas single this year with your co-star Jason Segel. And let me play a little bit of it for you.
Peace on earth.
So this is a rockin' rendition of Little Drummer Boy. Do you sort of
not just Little Drummer Boy, but David Bowie and Bing Crosby's version called Peace on Earth, Drummer Boy?
Can it be every child must be made aware?
Do you secretly wish you could have had Christmas growing up?
Yes, it's true, and I think it's true for a lot of young Jews. They look at all the bells and whistles across the street at the Christmas house with all their lights and the magical red fat man and the magic horses that fly with red noses. These are things that we have to just look at and envy.
You would look at
a
your
lot of us have Christmas envy. We would never admit it, but we've got the menorah, which is cool.
Cool.
We got
cool.
The dreidels.
That's cool.
I've actually incorporated some of their magic into our Hanukkah celebrations.
What do you do?
Well, sometimes we'll have a Hanukkah bush. We adorn it with not the Christmas colors. We put the blue tinsel and the blue things with the Star of David at the top.
Yeah, that works.
But we don't have a Hanukkah Santa. That would be taking it too far, I think.
That's Jack Black. He's the star of the new film Gulliver's Travels. It opens today. Jack Black, thank you, and Merry Christmas to your family.
Thank you very much. Happy Christmaka.
One more question for you.
Yes?
Is it true that you're not hardcore unless you live hardcore?
Absolutely. And the legend of the Rent is way hardcore.
One, two, three. Well, you're not hardcore.
We're going to focus now on two Golden Globe-nominated performances. Best Actor nominee Kevin Spacey plays disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff in the comedy Casino Jack. And Best Actress nominee Nicole Kidman plays a wife dealing with family tragedy in the drama Rabbit Hole. Bob Mondello says the performers choose two very different ways to illuminate their characters and, in the process, offer a masterclass in acting.
Casino Jack opens with Kevin Spacey brushing his teeth Jack Abramoff style, which is to say he's dressed to the nines, suit and tie, and it's a performance pitched straight into his bathroom mirror,
you know,
with him as audience.
People look at politicians and celebrities on the TV and the newspapers, glossy magazines. What do they see?
He leans into the mirror.
I'm just like them. That's what they say.
Jaunty, persuasive, convivial.
I'm different. I could be any one of them. Well, guess what? You can't. You know why? Because in reality, mediocrity is where most people live. Mediocrity is the elephant in the room. It's ubiquitous.
His eyes narrow. He jabs the toothbrush for emphasis.
Those of us who understand the disease of the dull, we do something about it. We do more because we have to. The deck was always stacked against us.
His eyes cloud with long-ago slights.
Some people say Jack Abramoff moves too fast. Jack Abramoff cuts corners. Well, I say to them, if that's the difference between me and my family having a good life and walking and using the subway every day, then so be it.
He's turning red.
I will not allow my family to be slaves. I will not allow the world I touch to be vanilla.
Implacable.
You say I'm selfish? F*** you. I give back plenty. You say I got a big ego? F*** you twice. I'm humbly grateful for the wonderful gifts that I've received here in America, the greatest country on this planet.
A head roll to loosen the collar.
I'm Jack Abramoff. And oh yeah, I work out every day.
Big audience laugh on that line, because as soon as he delivers it, he relaxes his jaw, puts the toothbrush back in, and he's just a guy brushing his teeth. This sequence in Casino Jack is one continuous shot, a spoken aria that lasts just over a minute and 40 seconds. And by the time it's done, you know not just all you need to know about the character, but how the actor and the film are going to approach the character. Jack Abramoff caused a lot of pain, frauds perpetrated, lives ruined, money squandered. But in Casino Jack, his arrogance will be played for comedy, bruising, slashing, larger than life, just like Spacey's performance. Now take an early moment in Rabbit Hole, an intimate look at a marriage unraveling after a terrible loss. Nicole Kidman plays Becca, a character who is keeping a tight rein on her emotions, which is always tricky to communicate on screen. Becca is afraid that if she lets herself feel, she'll feel too much, something you realize when her husband dims the lights and puts on Al Green, and her eyes signal that she recognizes a slippery slope. This is clearly an old routine.
You need to relax.
She shoots him a sly smile, arches an eyebrow, but it's all a mask. As he moves behind her to rub her back and he can no longer see her face, her smile fades, eyes go someplace far away, someplace full of hurt.
Your shoulders are all knotted up.
An eyebrow arches as if to say, duh.
Yeah.
Forget about Debbie.
The friend who hasn't called. Pain clouds her eyes.
Whatever else is bothering you.
She leans back into a kiss on her neck.
I know what this is. Dimming the lights. You're trying to seduce me. You're plying me with liquor.
It worked in college.
It's working again. She's letting go, her eyes closed, then pop open in panic at the emotion she has almost let herself feel. As she pulls away, you can see the wall go back up, and so can he.
Where are you going?
I'm feeling antsy tonight, I'm sorry.
Can anyone inhabit two emotions simultaneously better than Nicole Kidman? Tiny flickers of doubt inflecting a smile, eyes hopeful even as they brim with tears. A moment later, she gets a laugh with an Al Green crack and she's barely changed her tone of voice. It's all so intimate, calibrated to the internal struggles depicted in Rabbit Hole, just as Spacey's Casino Jack performance is outsized, befitting a guy who affects geopolitics. Each film prompts both laughs and tears. Each character is written with considerable wit, but the performances, worlds apart. Kidman has tailored Becca for quiet desperation. Spacey's given Abramoff the desperation of a clown. I'm Bob Mondello.
Joel and Ethan Coen's True Grit opens in theaters next week. The Western is set in the 1870s, and it stars Jeff Bridges, Matt Damon, and newcomer Hailee Steinfeld, making her film debut as 14-year-old Maddie Ross. Unlike the earlier film version of True Grit, which centered on John Wayne, this film restores Maddie Ross as the narrator and central figure, as she is in the 1968 novel written by Charles Portis. This Maddie Ross is a force to be reckoned with, sober and intense, with long dark braids and her father's Stetson. In this scene, she's hiring U.S. Marshal Rooster Cogburn to chase down the man who robbed and killed her father, and she's demanding he take her along to see the job done.
Here's the money. Now, I am to get Tom Chaney, and if you are not game, I will find somebody who is game. All I've heard out of you so far is talk. I know you can drink whiskey and snore and spit and wallow in filth and bemoan your station. The rest has been braggadocio. They told me you had grit, and that is why I came to you. I'm not paying for talk. I can get all the talk I need and more at the Monarch boarding house.
That's Haley Steinfeld as the fiercely stubborn and very funny Maddie Ross in True Grit. And Haley joins us now from New York. Welcome to the program, Haley.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this character out to avenge her father's blood at age 14. She's got a lot of grit herself.
Yes. I think that really to this girl, I mean, you know, obviously revenge, the idea of revenge coming from a 14-year-old girl isn't, you know, exactly right. It's more of what she thinks is doing the right thing. I like to think of it as, you know, her younger brother would wake up in the middle of the night and, you know, ask where dad is. And she couldn't sit there and watch, you know, her mother be completely grief-stricken. She took it upon herself to go out and, you know, of course, do what she thinks is right.
You were laughing a little bit just now, Haley, as we listened to that scene from the movie.
Yes.
Why were you laughing?
It's kind of funny because I love the fact that the stuff that comes out of this girl's mouth is stuff that you would never hear from a 14-year-old girl.
Braggadocio.
And so,
yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so that was a lot of fun to film and to hear it like that. It's funny.
She knows a lot, Maddie Ross does. She's very well educated. She's got a big vocabulary. She is really smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what's so great about her. There's so much to this girl, you know. What, you know, she's smart, she's clever. The way she handles her problems, you know, she thinks things through all the way. And that's what's so, you know, cool about her is not only, I mean, I love the fact that as much as she comes off as being this, you know, tough, witty, gritty girl, which she is, she's still a 14-year-old girl. She still, you know, takes after her mother, who, you know, the feminine side. But then, you know, she's being confronted by these men. And that's where her grit comes out, I feel.
Mm.
My name is LaBeef. I've just come from Yale County.
We have no rodeo clowns in Yale County.
Can I tell you about one of the scenes in the movie that just, I could not stop laughing. And it's a really small thing, but it's when you're lying in bed, you wake up and you realize that Matt Damon's character, the Texas Ranger, LaBeef, is sitting in your room.
Yes.
You haven't talked to him really before. And you start talking and you're trying to figure out who he is. And this is a man with, as we learned, some ego. And
right.
He does this thing where he gets this faraway look in his eyes, and he kind of opens his vest a little bit to show his badge.
Mm-hmm.
And he delivers this line, "I am a Texas Ranger."
That's right. I'm a Texas Ranger.
And there's something about the way he says that line, which you can just, it's all wrapped up in those few words about how he feels about himself.
It's that scene, I do have to say, Matt and I could not get through that without laughing.
Oh, I'm sorry that you were paid piece work and not on wages, and that you have been eluded the winter long by a half-wit.
You give out very little sugar with your pronouncements. While I sat there watching you, I gave some thought to stealing a kiss, though you are very young and sick and unattractive to boot. But now I have a mind to give you 5 or 6 good licks with my belt.
One would be as unpleasant as the other. If you wet your comb, I might tame that cowlick.
When you auditioned for Joel and Ethan Coen for this part of Maddie Ross, what do you think it was that convinced them that you were that character? This is your first feature film ever. They were taking a gamble, really.
I went into the audition. When I went to read for them, I went in dressed in character and, you know, and kind of what my vision of this character was. And I really think that's what it was, is my vision kind of clicked with theirs.
You said you were dressed in character for the audition.
Yes.
What were you wearing?
It's kind of embarrassing. My mom helped me with that. She actually, the day before the audition, I think it was like 9 o'clock, we ran out to Joann's and she got...
the fabric store.
Yes. She got, I guess you could call it like a corduroy burlap kind of material skirt. She sewed it together and I wore boots. And this ruffled up 1800s looking shirt from a thrift shop. That was it.
Did you have the hat that you wear your dad's hat through the movie?
I did not have a hat. I actually put my hair back up in a messy bun.
I think the hat kind of makes the character. When you put that hat on in the movie, did you feel like, okay, I'm writing off?
Yeah. It's that kind of finishing touch, basically. You know, she puts that hat on, and like you said, she's ready to go. And I think that, you know, that's like, you know, she has her dad's jacket, she's got her dad's, you know, his belt and you know, his pants. But I think that hat is what means, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, the fact that this girl is looking for, you know, a father figure and she doesn't have anyone out there with her. And at the end of the day, her horse is her best friend and her hat is the closest thing that she had to her dad and stuff like that. I think that's interesting to look for.
Would you stay in character after you were done with a day's shooting on True Grit? Would you try to be Mattie Ross? Would you try to leave her behind? What worked?
You know, I just think the character grew on me so much that I just kind of, I don't know, and the locations we were in had so much to do with it. You know, we were in such remote locations in the middle of nowhere. And it just kind of puts you in that mindset, I guess. And I just, you know, I would go home at the end of the day and that, I don't know why, but that accent would stay with me. But you know, I was still myself. I'd go home and text my friends and video chat with my friends. And then I'd go back to set the next day. And, you know, you go through hair and makeup, you go through wardrobe. And it's so amazing that, you know, what little that can do to your to make your performance even better. And so, I mean, I guess neither. But I think it just kind of grew on me so much that I just kind of, it was just like naturally became a part of me.
Well, Haley Steinfeld, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much and congratulations.
Thank you, Alyssa.
That's Haley Steinfeld, who just turned 14 herself, talking about her film debut as Mattie Ross in the new movie True Grit.
In his latest movie, Ben Affleck plays a man who comes home early one day. He's got some news, which he tries to deliver calmly to his wife, played by Rosemary DeWitt.
They fired me. They fired me today. Sally Wilcox.
Why?
Something about redundancies.
Affleck's character worked for a company that's coming apart. The movie The Company Men features many stars, including Tommy Lee Jones, Maria Bello, Chris Cooper, Kevin Costner, yet Affleck told us it was hard to find financing.
There's some nervousness about making a movie about people who have lost their jobs because the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, well, nobody wants to see that. And I think the subject matter was a tremendous stumbling block. Some people likened it to Iraq war movies when Iraq was the thing in the national consciousness that was the most painful. A lot of people wanted to avert their gaze, and people thought, well, this is going to be the same kind of thing. And so there were a lot of concerns. Now he still did get it financed, but it wasn't, you know, if it had been about an asteroid crashing into the planet, I think they would have had a much easier time.
We should mention your character is one of three guys who worked for a shipbuilding company, and they're driven out one by one. And it's interesting to see the way that all three of you, you, Chris Cooper, and Tommy Lee Jones, play those roles, because is it fair to say that each one of you is quite restrained? The characters are seem to be holding something in all the time.
Yeah, I think the restrained quality is that sort of pain one feels and that lack of surety about, you know, losing one's identity. You know, when this sands shift under you that much, the only thing that many people I talk to in researching have to hold them together is just their own composure, you know, and if they feel like if they kind of let it go, if they show their own insecurity, everything would fall apart.
Did you say you researched this by talking to people who'd, what, been out of work?
Sure. I mean, I wish I could say it was a hard movie to research, but I didn't have to look any further than guys I grew up with and went to grade school with and high school with and who had really, you know, decent, reasonable, sometimes really good jobs. And boom, we're all of a sudden out of work.
Well, let's listen to one part of The Company Men where your character lets go a little bit, says a little bit of what he's feeling and thinking in a conversation with his wife in the driveway. Let's listen.
I've been to everybody we know and a lot of people I don't. And I have begged. For a lead, anything. There's thousands of new MBAs out there. No mortgage, no kids, work 90-hour work weeks for nothing. You want honesty, Maggie? I'm a 37-year-old unemployed loser who can't support his family.
There's going to be somebody in the audience who thinks he's exactly that person.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on. And the thing that was interesting to me was how common it was to feel like not just, oh, I lost my job, or I need money, or I need to find another job, the practical concerns, but the way it undermined people's whole sense of identity. You know, I've become a worthless person. I've become someone that I can't look in the eye. I don't want to look in the mirror.
Can I mention an old movie that came to mind as I was watching this? I'm just curious if it was on anybody's mind as they were putting together Company Men. The movie is The Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah, that's a wonderful movie. I mean,
let's describe it. It's from 1946. This, like your movie, is about three men. But in their case, in 1946, what they're doing is coming home from World War II and finding their lives very difficult to reassemble. Is there some parallel here?
I think there is. You know, it's also a movie about, you know, the American sense of self. and having to redefine that. And in that case, it's about this experience that completely disrupted and their identities and changed them, and also that America is changing. Obviously, this isn't a story about men who went off and fought the Second World War, which is quite a profound trauma in many cases, but it is a story about dealing with a certain kind of trauma and losing something, and also feeling alienated from one's own society.
I'm even thinking of a particular scene at the end of The Best Years of Our Lives, where one of the veterans is at an airfield and walking past hundreds and hundreds of abandoned warplanes, like one that he flew in.
I used to work in one of those.
Reviving old memories, huh?
Yeah, or maybe getting some of them out of my system.
Well, you can take your last look at these crates. We're breaking them up.
Yeah, I know. You're the junk man. You get everything sooner or later.
This is no junk. We're using this material for building prefabricated houses.
You don't need any help, do you?
Out of a job?
That's it.
I thought of that scene when looking at the scenes in Company Men, where two of the characters are walking through the wreckage of an old shipyard where they used to build ships.
Yeah, the sort of husks of their former life represented by these giant metal crafts. It's true, they're very similar. The irony is that the spending on those kinds of airplanes in the Second World War was ultimately what kind of kickstarted the age of American prosperity in the 50s and 60s and into a little bit of the 70s, whereas the relics of the ships in this movie indicate a trend downward, something being left behind that can't be recovered.
There's a line in Company Men that's staying with me. Tommy Lee Jones is at a corporate conference table. Someone else at the conference table is discussing their plans to lay off a bunch of workers, and nearly all the workers being laid off are older, which could be construed as being wrong or illegal. Someone at the table says, oh no, this is going to pass legal scrutiny, and Jones responds, I always thought we aimed for a little higher standard than that.
That speaks so perfectly to people's feelings about our country. It's like, it's just about getting by, or people can like let people go if they can get away with it. That there's no deeper sense of right or wrong. The banks shouldn't, people shouldn't make such a giant profit off just moving money back and forth. The CEO's pays shouldn't be 200 times the average worker. It used to be 9 times. And okay, maybe it's legal, maybe it passes muster with shareholders, but there's something about us that fundamentally feels it isn't right. And I think that's the frustration that you feel on people speaking out from the left. I think it's the same frustration you hear from Tea Party activists. And that tells you that it's common to the entire spectrum of American people. We have a deep sense that what's happening is wrong and unethical, and that we're in decline because we've lost our moral compass.
Well, Ben Affleck, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
It's been my real pleasure. This is a lovely conversation, and I'm really grateful that you had me on the show.
Here's an actor to keep your eye on, Anthony Mackie. In The Hurt Locker, he was the tightly wound sergeant butting heads with a fellow soldier in his bomb disposal unit.
Well, it's too bad. First time working together. What do you think?
I think us working together means I talk to you and you talk to me.
You going on a date, Sanborn?
No. We're going on a mission. And my job is to keep you safe so we can keep going on missions.
It's combat, buddy.
Hey, it's just 39 days. 38 if we survive today.
Since The Hurt Locker, Mackie has gone on to other films. And the latest is in art house theaters now. It's called Night Catches Us. NPR's Netta Ullaby interviewed the actor in New York, where he's living part-time.
I asked Anthony Mackie's agent if we could meet someplace special to him. We ended up at his favorite bar, where he was playful with the doorman.
Easy, don't call security.
How are you?
Good to see you. Just come and get some sangria.
The place, Fig and Olive, is elegant, airy, tucked on a side street in the meatpacking district. The people who run it sometimes let Mackie live a fantasy.
I've always wanted to be a bartender, so I started hanging out with my friends here. I go and they let me get behind the bar and bartend.
On screen, Mackie is playing a very different role. In the movie Night Catches Us, he's a former Black Panther. The film set in the mid-1970s, and Mackie's character is suspected by everyone in his splintered Philadelphia neighborhood of informing to the FBI.
I got a message from the brothers.
They sent you?
Things done changed, snitch. I'm in charge now.
Got everybody fooled, huh? Go home.
Mackie was drawn to this tiny, low-budget movie because it explores a moment in black history neglected by Hollywood. And he loved its richly regretful main character. He's a revolutionary disillusioned by the Panthers' collapse.
You know, you build this beautiful house of smoke and mirrors and cars, and then it just crumbles. And I'm kind of in the place of rebuilding that crumbled card house.
Night Catches Us got a lot of positive buzz when it opened at Sundance last year. It's the first film from director Tonya Hamilton. She says Mackie brought understated torment and fury to the role.
But the fury is very tempered. You know, it's something that Mackie does really well. You know that there's warning under the surface. You know that the edge is so palpable and real, and yet he doesn't have to raise his voice. It's all in his eyes.
It meant everything for this first-time filmmaker to work with such a seasoned veteran. Mackie's only 31 years old, but he's been directed by the likes of Clint Eastwood and Jonathan Demme.
He kind of held my hand a little bit.
Tonya Hamilton's two leads, Anthony Mackie and Kerry Washington, have co-starred together before in Spike Lee's She Hate Me. Still, when it came time to direct their love scene, Tonya Hamilton got nervous.
Both of them said, okay, just step back. Here's how you do it. And they were like, you go here, you know, on the chair, on the floor. That was, I think, how generous he was as an actor to give me these little pieces that I didn't have.
But Mackie is part of a lineage of artists dedicated to bringing intelligent black stories to the screen. He's been mentored since high school by the actor Wendell Pierce, who played Bunk on The Wire. Both are from New Orleans. When Mackie was 14, Pierce visited his school.
And I had never seen this broad, statuesque black man in a pure white linen suit. Ever since then, I've just kind of been like running behind him like I was a rabbit and he had a carrot in his butt.
Mackie says Pierce is one of the forces who shaped his career. Another is his dad, who worked in construction.
Back West Louisiana, he didn't make it out of eighth grade.
Anthony Mackie's dad died tragically during Hurricane Katrina. When Mackie was growing up, his summers were spent working on roofs with his dad mopping tar.
My dad would pay me by how many squares of shingles I could put down. And this was before nail guns, when we couldn't afford nail guns. So literally, you're walking across a roof all day, 100-degree heat. And my dad would be like, you like this work? And I'd say, I hate it. And he'd be like, well, that's why you got to go to college. And I'm like, you don't have to worry about me.
One of Mackie's brothers went to law school. Another became a professor of engineering. Mackie went to Juilliard, Wendell Pierce's alma mater. He got a work-study scholarship with the school's physical plant. At first, he struggled. He even got put on probation after his first year. But he pulled himself together. Soon he was outpacing his classmates. He starred in an off-off-Broadway play before graduating. And when he did graduate, director Curtis Hanson cast Mackie as Eminem's enemy in the 2002 movie 8 Mile.
8 Mile was one of those things. I was a deer in headlights. You know, I showed up to set and Curtis Hanson was like, do this. And I was like, dude, I have no idea what you're talking about. So we're on set and I'm supposed to play a rapper and there are all these real rappers on set. So I was like, I got to beef my machismo up. I can't let these dudes punk me, you know, because people were saying some crazy stuff. Like, you don't deserve to be in this movie. You ain't real. So I was like, oh, I'm real. You know?
These days, the project that's keeping Mackie's cell phone ringing is not a movie. It's his own bar. He's opening one in Bed-Stuy, New York. Guess who's building the furniture?
I built a counter like this, 16 feet long. I built 24-inch by 20-inch two tops. That's my therapy. I bought a saw, I bought a router, bought all my bits. So now I just go around the neighborhood, find wood, make it into stuff.
I'm processing the idea of this guy in Academy Award-winning movies, scavenging.
The bar should open next year. Mackie lives in Bed-Stuy and New Orleans, where his girlfriend stays with their son. He says when he's back in New Orleans, there's one chore he will never do.
If there's a leak on my roof today, I don't care. I'll burn the house down before I get on the roof.
In the next year, Anthony Mackie's slate of films include one with Matt Damon called The Adjustment Bureau, based on a Philip K. Dick short story. More than anything, he'd love to play Jesse Owens, the Olympic athlete who defied Hitler. He's got a script. He's looking for a producer. Netta Ulibi, NPR News. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.